So yeah, as you said, I'm a platform security strategist for Adobe. And I do a couple of different things there. Primarily what I do is I look at the security of Adobe products and services and I try to make sure that they go out securely. They are free of software security bugs and that end users will be appropriately protected. I wrote a tool called Swift Investigator. That tool is probably not of interest to you guys, but the reason why I bring it up is just to let you guys know sort of where I am. I can do software development. I spent 4 years as a software developer early in my career. But what I do today is not software development. The Swift Investigator tool is a side project, so I keep my skills up. But if you ask me detailed questions about whether we dynamically link or statically link some Microsoft library within the code, I will not be able to tell you because I didn't actually write the code. My job is to keep an aesthetic distance so that I can look at the code objectively. Not that there would be any problems with my code, but you know, it looks better on paper if I can keep it objective perspective. And as you said, I help with incident response and other things. So, and I've been doing this work in the security community for about 15 years. What I'm going to speak about is, I'm going to start by giving you an overview of Flash Player. The product within Adobe most people know me for working on is Flash Player. And it has sort of an interesting update history. It's where I have the most knowledge and stats. So I'm going to start with that. Then we'll talk a little bit about recent security challenges with updates. As a security person, I'm going to sidebar this conversation a little bit to talk about security incidents that are related to software updates. And then I'm going to talk about some of the more modern stuff that we're doing with other Adobe products, like what we're doing with Creative Cloud updaters, what we're doing with ColdFusion updaters and the like, just to sort of show you where we're headed in the future. And then I'll give you guys a few tips if you have to actually advance a software updater within an organization. So to start off, let me just give you some background on Flash Player. Flash Player is an interesting piece of software to update because it's not an application. It's not an independent process running on the machine. Flash Player is a DLL that's loaded by the browser. So that makes a couple of changes in how you approach software updates, right? You can't check to see whether Flash Player is running or not without spidering all the processes and seeing which processes have loaded that DLL and sort of a hard thing to do. So some of the traditional software update tasks don't apply because we're actually a DLL. So unlike most applications, it's hard to tell if it's in use. There are actually different DLLs for different browsers because we behave differently in different browsers, so there's multiple Flash Player DLLs. And for the most part, end users don't directly know that we're on the machine. We don't show up in their start menu. There's no desktop icon for Flash Player. On the other hand, we are like a traditional app. We still have to register with add remove programs. We still add tasks to the Windows task scheduler. For our RLL update, we have to register the DLL with the operating system. We install a control panel icon so that people can control their Flash Player settings. And the Flash Player DLL installs in SQL and Windows, so we have to have administrative privilege to install a DLL. So it's sort of a weird hybrid of application to update. And when it comes to creating an update, we have to do many, many builds. Because we support Windows 8, we're natively part of Chrome. The Firefox implementation is slightly different because we run out of process and we have a sandbox in place. So Firefox has its own DLL. We run on Mac and Android, which are different operating systems, so we have to have builds for those operating systems. We support 32 and 64 bits, so we have to have builds for those operating systems. And then there's SDK builds and debugger builds that we have to be able to ship as well. So for us to go and actually go through the process of distributing an update, we have to create all these different builds. And then those builds go out through a number of different distribution channels. So if it's Chrome, the Flash Player is updated through the Chrome update mechanism, the core mechanism. We have many enterprise customers, so we have to be able to support update paths such as SMS and SCUF. For Windows 8, we're an integrated part of the operating system, so we are updated through Windows Update instead of our native installer. If you're an Android and you still have Flash on your Android phone, then you get through Google Play. Some people go to the website and download it directly, so we have to have standalone installers. We also have an auto-updater, so people get prompted for the updates. So we also, so in addition to doing all the builds, actually distributing it is quite complex as well, because we have to go out through all these different distribution channels. And then For a security update, if there's someone who's actively exploiting a vulnerability in Flash Player in the wild that we've never heard about, we have to go from getting the report that it's out there to shipping it to all the customers in 14 days or less. That means we have to get the sample, we have to debug it to find out where the crash is, we have to file the bug, we have to fix the bug, we have to test the bug, we have to incorporate the bug into the shippable branch, we have to test the shippable branch to make sure that it works inside all the installers, we have to get it prompted right on all those distribution channels, and we have to get it out to customers in 14 days or less. And that's...
where does 14 days come from?
It's just sort of an industry standard that we trust. And that's 14 calendar days, it's not 14 work days. So Saturdays and Sundays count too. But that's sort of the expected turnaround time for getting a software security update out to customers in order to get them protected. And if you're dealing with a web service, and you deal with web services, it's actually 2 to 3 days. So if there's like a vulnerability on Facebook or Office 360 online or something like that, the expectation is that you can respond to a security update in 2 to 3 days. Most people do it actually same day or within 24 to 48 hours. That's sort of the expectation within the industry in order to tell people that you're protecting customers. So we obviously care about update adoption. We care for a couple of reasons. One, we want to minimize the number of people that can get attacked through a security vulnerability. So we want to get everybody's patched as fast as possible so no one gets malware on the machine. And then also from the business side, we want update adoption because we're a development platform. So the sooner we can get all the features out to our customers, the sooner our developer groups can actually start leveraging those features, the sooner everyone becomes happy, right? And so you look at different ways of improving update adoption, and I thought I'd start with a quick side story that happened shortly before I started. It happened shortly after I started Node. So there was a security researcher who had found a vulnerability in FlashPlayer, and it was an impressive vulnerability, and it proved definitively that aliens did exist. The security community went wild over it. Partially because the vulnerability could work both in FlashPlayer, in Firefox and Internet Explorer, so it was a cross-browser bug, because FlashPlayer was consistent between the two, and also because he proved that a specific type of crash was exploitable that people did not think was exploitable before. So in this paper that he wrote, he proved that null pointer dereferences could be an exploitable condition, same as buffer overflows, same as manager overflows. So he wrote a huge paper, I don't think he wrote a 20-page paper. He didn't write the actual exploit given to people to this is why that guy is a good guy. But he did write the research on it. This is how you do it, this is how it did it, all of that. So the paper was 20 pages, he couldn't figure out how to write the exploit for 20 pages. Probably weren't an exploit writer. So he reported it to us, we showed the vulnerability, we put it out on all our distribution channels. And then it was sort of sitting there waiting. How long will it be before someone takes this paper and actually tries to implement it in the real world and starts attacking customers? And what are they going to do with it? Software exploits are used in government-to-government attacks. They're used in espionage between companies. You knew that someone was going to use it, and B, they were going to use it to do something interesting. Right. So then we just started waiting. Like a month goes by, and it hasn't been used in a while yet. And then I begin to wonder, what's going on? Why is it taking so long? But eventually, I get this email from one of our program managers, and she's like, did you guys do something to the updaters without telling me? No. Why? She's like, we're getting huge spikes in the number of downloads. Like, we've gone up 10% in the last hour or so, right? And we don't really sure why, right? Like, we published a thing a month ago. We haven't done any new updates since then. So, you know, the update curve should have been on this downward waveform. They're like, okay, well, this is serious. Let's go look into it. And we looked into it, and we looked at all the refers for where people were downloading the update from. Because they're downloading it from the website to see what the refer was that they think they're supposed to update. And they were all from World of Warcraft websites. World of Warcraft. Well, that's all that sort of stuff. And so, I went to World of Warcraft site, and it's got this little breaking news panel up in the left-hand corner. I'm like, well, that's interesting. Usually they don't have one of those up there. Let's go see what it says.
And you go and look at it, and what happened was someone had finally weaponized the vulnerability. And they weren't using tech to attack other governments, they weren't using it to install malware on people's machines to steal their banking credentials. They were using it to steal World of Warcraft accounts. So the World of Warcraft guys found out, they posted a warning on the website, hey, you're going to go update Flash Player, and otherwise you're going to lose your World of Warcraft here. And apparently this is a very good motivation for getting people to update. It's finally becomes real to them. They will drive home from work and update their computer that day if they think their World of Warcraft here is at risk. But it's obviously not the most, you just don't want to rely on a sense like this for your update strategy. Otherwise, people will eventually just install it. So, we started looking at some of the technical challenges with getting Flash Player updated, all these different systems, how can we improve adoption. And at the time when I started, if you went and you looked at the distribution of different versions of Flash Player out in the wild, you get a pie chart that looks like this, right? You're sort of pushing the limits of how many colors you can fit into a pie chart at this point. And or represent a six-character hexadecimal HTML tag. This is not the sort of chart you want, right? You basically want like a pack-in chart. Like, current version, version 1 is fine. You don't want it to have all of this. But, if you look at the charts and looked at the like curves of update adoptions, it looks pretty. It sort of looks like mountain ranges. You've got planes down here. It makes for a very pretty chart, but not the chart you want to get, right? And part of this was from a couple different reasons. The reason why the charts were like this is we had a lot of different challenges. If you looked at the update range, you get about 25% would update in the first 4 to 6 weeks, 40% would update within about 2 months. Say, to get to 75%, you'll get 3 to 4 months, and then there were 25% of the people who were almost never updated or jumped, waiting very a year or more to update or something like that. So that wasn't good. If you look at the graph, one of the things that I did is I consolidated all of the different versions because one release would have different version numbers depending on whether it was a Chrome release or an Android release or something like that. And basically what you see is, people all search an update and then we give a new release and then, before we got all those people updated, we'd have another release. Before we got all those people updated, we'd do another release. So we never actually get system penetration. Now, there's a lot of different reasons for this. Some of this has been skewed by internet cafes. Internet cafes tend to reset they're basically like VMs with a snapshot. They reset back to the snapshot at the beginning of every day in order to clear off everything that people have put on there during the course of the day. So those would always reset back to whatever version they had and then they would eventually update. So they keep updating every day. Enterprises are always on their own update schedules. They don't want to push anything out that they have reviewed. You got end users who prefer them. We have different version numbers for different distributions, which make the math weird. And the different distribution methods would have different rates of success. Like pushing something out on Google Play would have a different success rate than the automatic updater, which would have a different success rate than what was going on in enterprises. And then, Murphy's Law and Chaos Theory is always present. So we had a bunch of challenges with improving it. But the one thing we did know is that the goal for a security update, what we wanted to do with security updates, is get it within 2 months or less. So this is the detections of a vulnerability in 2011. And so what you see here is, this is, like I said, vulnerabilities tend to be used in targeted attacks these days. They're used governments, or rogue group, but they tend to be used very targeted way. It's not a mass campaign, it's I want to exploit you and I want to exploit you specifically. So what would happen is they'd be being used by a small group of people early on, and it would sort of spike, and this was roughly when they would figure out that we knew about it. Right? And then once they knew the world knew about it, they would stop because they're trying to do everything in cloak and dagger and they don't want to be detected, so they switch. But eventually the information gets up on the web, and there's a second tier of attackers who are your general malware writers. So the guys who send you the Viagra emails and the penny stock emails and all that sort of spam that you get. And those guys don't care whether or not they get detected. They're not trying to be cloak and dagger or very upfront about what they're doing. Because they all live in places where they're never going to be prosecuted. So they don't care who they are. No one's going to attack them anyway. And it takes them about basically 2 months to actually take the exploit that the really bright guys who are doing targeted attack up here, take what they had, recode it, to work with their malware, start distributing this malware. And so this is when it starts to hit general populace as general malware. And this is about a 2 month long. So ideally, you want to be able to stop all these attacks here by getting your update out on people's platforms right here, you know, somewhere in this range. Because you don't want this to happen. So that was sort of our goal. One of the update distribution methods that we had was content on websites to encourage you to upgrade to the latest version of FlashLayer. This was actually useful. Actually, we got a lot of upgrades this way. Because what would happen is, you know, our partners like Google or Facebook, if they knew an exploit was out in the wild, and especially if that exploit might target Facebook customers, they would just update a version requirement on their website so that everybody would update and everybody using Facebook would be protected. That's great, right? Like it's another way of encouraging people to update besides the update prompt you get on your operating system. The problem with that was it trains people to trust links to go update FlashLayer from websites, and so it opens the door for fake FlashLayer updates. And then people that try to ride away and go, hey, there's a security vulnerability, update Flash. By the way, I've got the update for you right here. Right? Just install this Trojan. It's Flash, trust me. So that's another problem, yeah. Is when you go, you prompt people to go and do a software update, and it's a very popular update, malware with this great fake version that they try to give you back. So,
I just have a question. Do they tend to take Flash itself and put malware in it, or
do
they tend to just like test
what's
completely
unrelated? So, like, they tend to have something completely unrelated. They will take our website content and they will fake our website. So it'll look exactly like our website, except it'll be like Adobe with 3 E's or something like that, right? They do that type of stuff because most end users don't know what domain names. Especially with Akamai domain names and stuff like that. With load balancer get domain names like get3.w.com. No one's going to know what your domain names mean. Whether that other stuff. So we want to look at updater improvements. So the first thing we looked at was silent level updaters. Like everybody tends to like Chrome's model doing a silent level update because you just never have to think about it. Outside of mind, you just start Chrome with updates. But it took a while for a lot of organizations to jump onto that because there were some legal considerations. There are laws in different countries about which sort of modifications you can make to people's computers. They vary from country to country, and some of them are vaguely written because they're written by lawyers, not by science people. And so some of them are written so vaguely that setting a cookie on somebody's computer without prompting them could be considered a violation of the law. Because you've written something to their hard disk where they did not explicitly approve to do that. So, a lot of people stood back and there's like a wait and see, like, are they going to use common sense application of this law or are they going to rewrite it when that's there? And then you also have to deal with terms of service to which you use. If we make an update to FlashLayer that's a significant change to the user license agreement, we can't simultaneously all that update you. We have to prompt you to see if you agree to the new license agreement, and then if you agree to the new license agreement, then but we can't change the EULA underneath you with a silent update. So we had to look at that. So that means that we had to have two different systems, one that where we do allow the update to prompt you, one where it was silent. You have race conditions with non-silent updates. We wanted to make sure we could update all the different DLLs on the machine. Enterprise controls are very important to a large software vendor. They're unscalable, so now we had to have enterprise controls to disable the silent level update for people who want to have managed them. But we also designed it such that if they wanted to piggyback on the silent update system, they can make their own silent update server and just redirect FlashLayer to the silent update server within their environment. And then they could more easily update the end users by taking advantage of the silent system and also have the control of having the updates come from their side where they can make sure that they didn't
solve the big block priorities.
We made it so that it worked both on Windows and Mac. And these things didn't take a lot of beta testing. There are a lot of subtle bugs that can go wrong, and it's hard to debug them because the end user doesn't know what happens because you did it silently. Things just stop working. So, for instance, when we did silent hello with your greeter, we first shipped the code to end users in October, and then we did a beta test where about 1% of the population of greeter could actually opt into it. For greeter, it had 98% penetration on the internet, so you're still talking about millions of customers, you're talking about 1%. And then when we got through all the bugs from those 1%, we activated it in April. Because like, in December, you never do an update. And then it worked. We were able to do a silent hello updater. We had to go through all the check analysis to make sure end users have controls. So when it shipped, we had to make sure that they chose to do silent hello updates. We couldn't silent hello update the machine without allowing for silent updates. Some users wanted to be notified every time they did an update because they wanted to track all the changes to their machine. So we had to prompt them to install, and also in our control panel, we had to give them choices so they could go and change their mind later. We might have other things in there to let you know that both the version numbers of your different DLLs had the ability to do force an update if they were doing that. So we created those controls. And the way we had to plan it out was, FlashBlade is installed on like 98% of the world's machines, right? If they all update at midnight during your stream time, we will kill the internet. Right? We cannot update everybody at the exact same time. Your cable that runs between here and Africa will start boil to completion. So it's like, okay, we'll distribute everything. Yeah, we'll just randomly move times throughout the day. You're at 3, you're at 4, you're at 5. And have them check. But then he writes the problem of, well, what if I pick like 4:15 a.m., right? 4:15 a.m., even night owls can be a bed at 4:15 a.m., right? So then what it has to do is it has to check every hour after that. So if you shut down your computer every day, when you go to bed at night, and you don't open your laptop up until 6 in the morning, we still need to be able to update that machine. So we set a task at 4:15, and then it checks every hour after that, until it gets a response from the server, and then if it says that there's no update, then the updater basically goes to sleep for the rest of the day and it's checking every hour until 4:15 comes around the next day. And then it starts checking every hour until it's responding to the server. And do that way. You had to plan for the fact that your browser may be running and the DLL may be in use. Swapping out a DLL and a running application is dangerous in queue. Likely cause a crash. So we had to set it up so that there are different DLL names for each version, and we put the new DLL on the system, move the registry pointer to the new DLL. If your application was running under the old DLL, that's fine, it's still there, but new DLL is there for any new processes that start, any new processes that come forward to load the new DLL. All right, so we had to plan through the fact that your browser may be in use at the time of stopping the DLL update. And we had to make sure that the design works without prompts, without starting a UAC prompt on Windows, right? Because when you install SQL on Windows, you have to have administrative privileges. You can't necessarily assign a hello up there to get a UAC prompt. So we had to, when you first installed the silent hello up there, it would ask you for admin privileges, and would register a task under the admin account, and then the task scheduler for the admin account would actually run a silent hello up there so the user can get a UAC prompt. It didn't work for like all these little design details of getting it to work. And we did the same thing for readers so that they have silent hello up there. And it was great. We launched it March 2012. Updated approximately 600 million users in about 48 hours, which is pretty good. That doesn't count Chrome updates and other distribution channels, just the silent hello update channel. So great, we're updating 600 million users in 48 hours, that solves all the graph problems. Except for the next problem you run into is you start to have download spikes of about 750 gigabits per second. Right? Because you're trying to update 600 million people in 48 hours, which is like 10 million power. So then you have to solve the bandwidth problem. Because, well, Akamai is more than happy to charge us for 750 gigabits a second. We do have to share the internet with other people. So then we move to doing a differential updater with the goal of reducing my RSI by about 75%. Based on some existing tools, we didn't want to reinvent the wheels. We use BSD, DIP, BSD patch, we know those tools. And you have to, with any differential updater, you have to think through all the different problems, like whether more than one version update, and you have to be able to call back to the original full installers with the DIP on some of these more than one version update. And so far, it's been pretty successful. We're still collecting stats. And then for all the people that refuse to use the updater, we've been working with partners. So, like, if you have a Mac and you have Safari, and you get too far out of date, Mac will just tell you, okay, we're just not running Flatware again, so you update. Firefox, same thing, if you get too far out of date, and because you turned it off, we'll eventually say, okay, we're just not going to load Flatware until you update. Or, if you want to manually update, take the risk you can, but you have been forewarned that you're about to run all of them. So we've been working through a lot of those update problems. And so far it's been successful, it's cleaned up our graphs. But there's another problem going on in the security industry, and this is where I'm going to sort of sidetrack into security challenges. I have a security guy who might hear most about software updates and security aspects. And if you've been reading the press, the new it thing for attackers is stealing digital code signatures. Stealing the things that you're stealing the keys that you're using to distribute all the signatures. Adobe, I think, someone was actually able to steal their certificate. They weren't actually able to steal the key itself, it was in the hardware signing module. But what they did is they compromised the build server that talks to the hardware signing module, and then used the build server's account to sign malware on their behalf. The government got hit, Firms got hit, Bit9, which is a security company, got hit. All of these companies have been hit. If you follow like some of the bigger security stories like Stuxnet, Flame, Dooku, where security vulnerabilities are being used to target nuclear reactors in Israel and stuff like that, those don't involve the big code signatures. If you like to play Chinese games, this is a whole list of another set of companies that got hit where their digital code signatures are this kind of size. And these are all gaming companies in Asia that got hit. Conspiracy Lab did the story about the group behind this. It was actually one group that was going through stealing all these certificates to do its tasks. And it's great, because if you have a valid code signing certificate, then you can install stuff on the software. You bypass all the OS security controls. Because you've got a valid certificate, you're trusted by your sign, you're good. In addition to that, they've been going after certificate authorities. In these two cases, they're going after SSL certificates, not code signing certificates. But a lot of these attackers are agnostic. They just attack and go with whatever they can grab. So in these instances, they're able to grab SSL certificates. And they use the SSL certificate, CA, to generate SSL certificates for Yahoo, Gmail, and all those other things. So they can create a big website that would show up as well as subvention under Google's name or under Yahoo's name. And actually just this week, on Wednesday, as in 2 days ago, Opera listed on their website that somebody had broken into their environment and sold code signing keys. So this was just 48 hours ago. There's two interesting things about this that I'm going to bring up. One is that they sold an old code sign certificate, but the other is they also used a software update distribution channel of Opera to ship their malware. So once they got the key, they signed their malware, and they threw it on the software update channel of Opera to push it out to all of their customers. Fortunately for Opera, they had never given. It was pretty good. I was paying attention to what was going on. They were just shut it down within 36 minutes. But understand, for a large software vendor, 36 minutes is an eternity. You're still talking about thousands, if not millions, of users. So like, if you do the math of Adobe updating 600 million in 48 hours, start doing the math for how many people were actually updating per minute, and you start to get an idea of scale with this. So this is a new thing, right? This is not only are they scaling CoSec distributions, but also transitioning out to software additionals. They're using the software updaters that you guys build to distribute them out. And one of the interesting aspects that I saw in their code yesterday, and I don't have detailed knowledge of this, I'm just going with what they posted on the website, is the certificate that they stole at Opera. It was an old code sign certificate. It was one for Opera 12 that didn't expire. But there are two problems. One is that the operating system won't necessarily block you from installing something with the old certificate. You'll get a different warning in Windows. In Mac, you have to actually run a command line to figure out whether it's expired or not, otherwise Mac just won't pay attention to the CoSec certificates, with the exception of Gatekeeper certificates. And the other was that they said, although in the future it would be possible to run our own checks on the certificate, download follow-up updates, conditions to those in the US. So their software distribution channel didn't actually check to see whether it was receiving either. They just went and talked to the download server, said, yay, I got an executable from Opera's website, address Opera's website, says, hey, that's us. And I just didn't run it. And so this is an important thing about when you're designing software update models. With Adobe, we actually do validate the certificate of everything we download before we run it to validate that it's correct and that not all software updaters do. So if you guys design these things, one of the things I would strongly encourage you guys to do is start thinking about how you can use this defense in depth measure for ensuring that the software updates that you're pulling down were actually the ones from the organization itself. So if you run an organization, store the keys and hardware signed onto a protected place and put them on like a wiki page, or store them in the Codeforce, readable directory and stuff like that. And sometimes you hear stories of people uploading their CoSec keys to GitHub because they just update the entire application. They update the CoSec key along with it. Use separate CoSec keys for separate tasks when you design your system for doing updates. This is one of the things that helps protect Flash Player and Reader. And Arcos, when we had Outreach and our digital CoSec certificate was misused, is that the certificate that we use to update Flash Player not the certificate that was stolen. If you have an architecture where one CoSec certificate rules them all, yes, you end up becoming one of those companies that was before, that means all of your software has to be reached. So great different CoSec certificates for the tasks, that way if someone does break into your organization. It's different. If you're writing the software updater, make sure you check the signatures of the stuff you download. Yes, you should be getting it from the trusted site, but there may be a man in the middle attack, and maybe someone takes over the site. So take the time to validate the certificate of what you just downloaded to make sure it looks legit before you run tests and install it. Check the timestamp on it, check for revocation, check the validity of the CA, do all those tasks. If possible, make sure you design your updaters to allow for secure communication channels. FlashBear checks on to see if there's a new version that does it over SSL. That way, a man in the middle can fly about location of the update or version that's available. And if you publish software hard in your repository, build servers are a common target these days in network breaches. So where you're actually building the code for your updates is a good target. And it's a good target for a couple reasons. One, it's where our source code is. Two, it's going to be chances are talks to the signed module to sign build once it's done. So as an attacker, if I get that machine, I can either try to use its privileges and perforce to check code in, or I can try to use it as a leverage to sign. So usually when attackers are coming in the network these days, they're going straight to build servers. Harden them, current network operating system stuff, this is one hour talk, I can't go into all the details. Limited access to build wikis and build environments are the reason the way they figured this out, they're going to read your wikis. And like, oh, this is how. Because the wikis and a lot of the companies are open, you can go find them and start reading them. Find out where the build servers are located by looking at the network patterns for the wiki. Find out how the distribution channel works by looking at the coders' wikis. Try to do security analysis on the entire environment. So that's my soapbox on security about software updates. go back to actually talking about software. So before I side channeled, I talked about the fact that we were updating our updaters. And this got the attention of XKCD, who had a little bit of fun at our expense. If you can't read it, it says, there's an update for Adobe Download Manager. This update will allow you to download new updates to the Adobe Update Downloader. And if you know XKCD and you do the mouse over, there's always a data joke in the mouse over. And the mouse over, they make fun of Java by saying, some pending mandatory software updates require version 21.1.2 of the Oracle Sun Java JDK Update Manager runtime environment meta updater, which is not available for your platform. So it's great that we can do all these updaters and we can do updates, but at the end of the day, people don't want to know about it, right? They don't want to find out that their World of Warcraft character is at risk. They just want to use their software and be on with their day. They don't have to stop and click update and all that, reboot their machine and all that sort of stuff. Within an organization, maybe it's solving different update needs, right? Development companies want better update adoption because getting new features faster to customers makes more sense. End users just don't want to deal with it. Enterprises want to be able to control it. It's great that you guys can update me in 48 hours, but I'm going to double check everything you give me because I have a managed environment. So you always have to pay attention to that. And a lot of times the developers who are trying to get the updates out, they mostly just want something that works. And updates can actually be mean different things depending on what you're working on. So at Adobe, we make updaters for all sorts of things. We have server software, we have runtime environments, we have desktop software, we have cloud services. Our hand is almost every type of application software, distributed mobile applications, all that sort of stuff. So one of the things that we want to improve updates on was cold fusion. If you've ever updated a Linux environment, it's like you got to stop the server, you got to make a backup of all the files, you got to copy the files in, you got to restart the server, then you miss the steps, then you got to shut it down again, then you got to go back and figure out what you missed, then you got to restart it. So with cold fusion, what we did is we make updated nominal updater into the server. So if you don't know what Cold Fusion is, it's basically Java plus Tomcat plus a platform, this software development SDK, which allows you to quickly make websites with minimal coding knowledge. And because we have because we're running a full server platform, we actually have a UI for administering the server. And so we added, you can go in, you can look at the available updates, there are check for updates buttons, there are download buttons, you can actually have the server install it for you. There's a little red thing that shows up in the corner telling you when you're out of date, you can go to the admin panel. One of the features that we added, which I think a lot of people like, is the server can email you when it's out of date, which is kind of convenient. So when you go to computer updates in the environment, you supply an email address, and you have to check for updates every 10 days and then email you when there's an update. That's somewhat convenient for people. So they don't have to check RSS feed to check the website or anything like that. And you can install all the instances, so it handles everything based on the update on the server. And including telling you which one updates you've installed, where the backup directory is, the uninstaller location, all that. So just because it was a server, it doesn't mean that we think about ways to do auto updates for the environment. We didn't let that slow us down. We actually created auto updates for that. Another updater thing that we worked on was Adobe Air. And Adobe Air is a runtime environment that allows you to create desktop applications using ActionScript. So if you're already a Flash developer and you're used to a way of creating website content using Flash, you take the same code, same language, make a desktop application. But since all these new people that were ActionScript developers were all website developers, we knew they didn't know a whole lot about doing software updates. That, and all the different things you gotta do in terms of checking the process, shutting down the process, downloading the file, changing the signature on the file, launching the installer, restarting the process, all that sort of stuff. So one of the things that we did with the runtime environment is we exposed our ILO updater to their application, so they can use the same updated infrastructure to update the applications they were building on top of that runtime. So if you create a desktop application upon the AR runtime, you could actually leverage our installer. And we would do all the work for you in terms of downloading the file, checking the signature on the file, stopping the process, installing it, restarting it, all of that. So if you're an ActionScript developer and you wanted to use the integrated updates functionality that came with the runtime environment, this is basically the code that you need to update your application. All you have, you provide a config file, which basically tells us where the updates are, all that. You provide the function which allows us to figure out whether the version is newer or not. You have the default one, but if you have some crazy versioning scheme, you just provide your own function that will tell us whether or not it's updated. It's not there or not. You add a couple of event listeners for different things, like when it's complete, all that sort of stuff, for errors. And then you call check now. So if you're a developer and you're building a desktop application using our runtime, you didn't have to write your own. Write one as part of the runtime. And all you had to do was write basically one class to call our updater and use it. And this was actually fairly successful to prevent people from having to reinvent the wheel. At Adobe, we used to, every like, product team have their own updater because, oh, we can't use this other team's updater because we have this one little quirk. Therefore, you know, we're going to invent our own wheel. Our wheel will be rounder than their wheel. So, and it was sort of frustrating because we had all these other applications. Another thing you're seeing with a lot of modern operating systems is sort of the App Store model, right? Macs have App Stores now. Windows 8 has App Stores. Google, Android, Chrome OS have App Stores. And in terms of software updates, this is another way that development companies are able to abstract having to deal with the update problem, right? I don't have to write an updater for Android. I just provide them my new version. They put it on the market. Their updater will install it on the Android platform. Great, right? Okay, I don't have to actually think about it. As a developer, I just make my application later so that they figure out how to install this update. And we thought that model was actually kind of cool because, like I said, we had all these other applications at Adobe where they all have their own sort of update thing. Right? Where Dreamweaver and Photoshop had different updaters because they both wanted to create their own wheel. Or, you know, Dreamweaver came from Macmedia, whereas Photoshop came from Adobe. So they both had different updaters when they started in different organizations before our merger and stuff like that. But we started this business model in the Creative Cloud. And if you know Adobe, we have what was known as the Creative Suite. The Creative Suite was all of your content editing and authoring applications that Adobe makes. Your Photoshops, your Dreamweavers, Illustrator, InDesign, Edition, video editing software, all that sort of stuff. It was all part of the Creative Suite. If you go to our website, you give us like $1,600, you download all the applications. But Adobe wanted to move that business model for and we followed the App Store model. We generated a unified updater where you can go, you can see all the applications that you currently have installed. It'll tell you whether they're up to date. And then you can see all the other applications that are available in the Creative Suite. Choose to install them. So, like this sort of looks like the Google Play interface. If you've ever gone and looked at your apps, lists all of them and tell you which ones are up to date or not. And they're always trying to get you down the more apps. And for the end user, this was actually nice because they had one updater they have to deal with. It tells them whether or not they're all up to date. And it shows them other stuff they may want to install if they ever created a lot of subscription. So we actually sort of borrowed that model for the Creative Cloud. But we didn't put it in enterprises. You can actually take that updater and you can run it as a command line. So if you have some group policy and you want to manage the, all of your Photoshop installations, your Pixar or something like that, you just want to manage everyone's for them. You can create a group policy, run a command line to invoke the application manager. It will talk to Adobe servers. Or if you're the type of environment where maybe you don't allow running out to the internet, you have to bring all the packages in-house. What we like to do is you run a web server inside your environment. That web server will go and pull down all the updates from the Adobe site so you can store them locally. And then you can have the command line auto update tool talk to your internal server rather than Adobe server. That's how you can get the updates to all the desktops in your environment. So that they're actually checking the updates there inside your network rather than talking directly to Adobe sites. And enterprises like this, they're always scared of like the operator network. Yeah. We'd rather download it ourselves, take a look at it. Once we confirm it's safe, we'll distribute it. Or once we confirm that the update won't break existing workflow, we'll distribute it. So we never try to get out of enterprises when we do our update models. And the other thing that's happening in a lot of organizations, just from the business side, is update cycles are increasing. And this is for different reasons. One is sort of the rise of software as a service models where you have Office 360 and Google Docs and stuff like that. Before, when everything was desktop software and you had to go to the store and buy it, you could do the waterfall development model where you update and create updates like once a year, ship new boxes and stuff like that. With software as a service can update any day in one. Most software as a service websites will actually update multiple times a day. Like Facebook. It was either Facebook or Singa who was like updating their website 20 times a day. Right? So they can do updates all day long. As soon as the piece of code is ready, it goes out the door. Right? So people who create desktop software have to keep up with this, and therefore they're increasing their update strategies. So you know, if you look at web desktop software, this is especially true because they're trying to keep up with all the innovation with HTML5. Right? New standards are coming out with HTML5 all the time, therefore you've got to keep up. And make sure that you're in this supporting all this stuff. So Flash Player, who is currently is updating once a month, Chrome updates once every 6 weeks, Firefox updates once every 6 weeks. The organizational model for shipping updates is becoming much faster. So when you're thinking about your software updates, you have to think about how are they going to impact the company's ability to ship stuff faster. Because that may be a selling point for your organization. Is it a streamlined tool where I can create a package update and get out to customers? Minimal process. Right? So Adobe returns your security updates within 14 days, therefore the update is there. Right? And everything inside the organization is changing to meet this. You always have to have a shippable branch ready, you have to be able to certify our builds, so we can come out, external communication, we have to call that sort of stuff, considering the impact of downstream customers. Mentioned updates that go wrong, internal and external. Tons of automation. They're able to ship all those different versions of the DLL and all those distribution panels and have to automate. And then, as part of that, because you're shipping so quickly, you also have to have response plans for when it goes wrong. Can you shut down the update system? Can you roll it back? Can you, what's going to happen if we start to ship an update out, you know, to 600 million users in 48 hours, and then we find out there's a bug. That's 12 hours in. They stop, they can roll back. And that's a concern of organizations when they're looking at updates. How are we going to be able to handle that condition with our update process? So that's something to think about when you're designing updates. And the last thing I'm going to talk about is. Within Adobe, I've had to encourage teams to improve their auto update systems. One of the things I have to do is I need to be able to security patches to improve it faster. But that doesn't always mean that security alone is enough to explain the benefits to organizations, right? Or like a differential updater. Yeah, differential updater will reduce costs. But let's say I've got one developer. Again, differential updater that reduces costs, right? Or I can have that same developer work on a feature that brings in more revenue. And has the added bonus of making a customer happy. If I'm trying to decide between the two tasks that I'm going to have to develop for you, the differential operator may not be at the top of the list. Even though it would reduce business costs, there's, you know, managers are always making decisions about what's the opportunity cost that has to have. What could I be pursuing in terms of new features and making the customer happy? go back and do this maintenance work. So it's sort of important to understand like business drivers that are of the adoption, how the tools that you guys are creating are going to fit into the model of actually getting shipped. Because no business ever actually shifts the technology solely because it's cool, right? Maybe some like Google R&D labs can have something like that. No one ever pays attention to it. But a lot of organizations that you know you're on budgets, you're on time scale, you know, from apps, all that sort of stuff. So you want to be able to describe the benefits to different groups and explain to different groups how your operators can be able to solve their issues. And depending on who you're talking to, you may need to be able to sell to different audiences. So like with the Creative Cloud team, the thing that made them find this all the everybody has their own update code. It was actually a business need. It wasn't like a sanity need of like dealing with the fact that everybody has their own update. It was a business need. The business need was basically, if you have a waterfall development model, your revenue is also sort of assigned to it. You release something new, you get all this, you know, revenue goes up because everybody's buying a new thing, and then you announce that the next version is going to come out, and everybody stops buying because they're waiting for the next version. Right, so as a company, you're rich, and then you're poor, and then you're rich, and then you're poor. It's a hard way to run a business, right? When a steady revenue stream. So we created cloud. What they did is they went to software as a service, form of software as a service, and all. Still desktop software, you still install it, you pay a monthly subscription. And then one of the advantages of that is they removed a different restriction we had, which is when you're on that waterfall model, you can only ship updates once a year. Right. So if I'm the Photoshop team and I've got the latest, greatest photo editing thing that allows you to remove your access from all of your photos, which we do actually have a photo in the future that doesn't work, you would have to sit on your hands and wait for all the other development teams to catch up with what they're doing, and then you could all ship in one big group. And if you're dealing with like trying to keep up with all the other photo editing software, that's hard, right? So your competition's going to get ahead of you, all that sort of stuff. So by going to a subscription-based model, what that allowed them to do is people can just go out whenever they're ready, as opposed to waiting for the next big bucket release where you go and pay $1,600 for a big bucket. You just pay a subscription model, and then we just ship the features whenever you need. So being able to improve revenue control was a reason to improve our update system so that we could be able to do the sort of software as a service model, desktop software. You need to be able to sell, like, how does it improve the business? Yes, your differential updater is cool, but how is that actually going to make things better? Right? And obviously, differential updaters reduce cost. But you need to be able to explain the other features. Right? The sooner customers see your features, the sooner they're happier. You can get bug fixes out to them quicker. And for every reason, Flash Parallel is a monthly update cycle. And it means that when there's a customer bug, we can fix it within 30 days as opposed to 3 months or 6 months. The laws you keep pace with the competition, you have to be able to complete new software as a service models where they just update their website to pay over the next day. So same thing for some of those issues. And security is another reason that you can use to sell it. Adobe is a big target because we have such wide distribution. You can attack our software, you can hit millions of people. So we had to go through and like set up the security stuff. One of the things from a security standpoint isn't just preventing the current attack. Yes, getting an update to the user prevents the current attack. But the other problem is if you're slow to update and people are slow to get your updates, you will be a more attractive target in the future. Because what the attackers are doing a cost benefit analysis in their head. It's going to cost so much to create the exploit. And then they have to look at, how much work is it to create the exploit, and then how long can I use that exploit before it gets shut off. And if it takes you like 3 months or longer to actually update everybody on the web, then you're an attractive target because I can actually use that. My window's pretty big. I get a return on investment for all that work I did to create the exploit. If it's something like Chrome or Adobe or something like that where there's growth faster around, you're going to create that 0 day, but then you're only going to get used. Because 14 days we're going to ship the update, and 2 days after that we'll have updated another thing. So you only get like 2 weeks soon to get the attack. So you don't get as much return on investment. The other thing that you need to appear, be able to deal with is a zero-day attack rarely occurs at any time of shift. You've gotten notified the day we ship that we ship something. It's like, yay, we ship something. Oh, here's a zero-day, we have to ship again. Right? Never ignore the enterprise. I mean, it always seems weird that enterprises try to, like, why don't you see Sprint Chrome SoundCloud updater? Why are you trying to prevent people from getting updates for the sake of it? But they do have the reasons, they are valid, and kind of time to go up them all here. Always think about the enterprise, because a large software vendor, especially when you're software used by a large software vendor, we have to care about these people because they're usually very big source of revenue. So always keep in mind, like, how can I do the enterprise installation? Sort of like what we did with the Creative Cloud stuff, where yeah, you have the centralized management, you have GUI, it looks like app stores, people will understand it because it looks like all the other app stores. But also, you know, still created this server, so you know, those environments. And then also, sounds like this also reduces customer fatigue. If you search the, I would not encourage you to go onto Twitter and search the place to flash and update, because we'll see some non-safe for work comments about flash updates. On Twitter, but people will be annoyed by them. But there's like VR benefits to be able to get to those sound updates and reduce customers. There's less of those Twitter comments now that we do with, you know, sound updates. And they're warning with every update. Like, thank you for installing. Please reboot your machine. Right? And then everybody gets upset to stop whatever they're doing to do with that. So understand the role of software that plays in your environment. It will make things much happier. So to close things out, not only updates and software updates, it's a technological challenge. How do we do it? The differential updater work? There's a digital signature attached to the binary. We've got to make sure that the digital signature not only updates the code, but also updates the digital signature for that binary at the same time. You can't update one without the other, so you have to go through all these technological challenges. How do you update, you know, 600 million users without crying the internet back up? There are definitely a security challenge. You know, you've got to be able to get software updates to customers faster. Hackers are increasing in numbers, so we have to improve our response time for it. There's tenfold more hackers now in the environment than there was when I first started in computer security. It's an operational challenge. You know, how do you do software as a service? How do you and a software updater work with our accelerated models? And it's a business challenge, right? Can it help us increase revenue, steady revenue? What is this going to do to make the business better? Those are all things you have to be able to think about and settle in your larger organization trying to build updaters. So it's know how they benefit. If you're going to sell the technologies to someone, make sure you understand how they benefit both the business and the customers. As you're designing your code, be aware that it's going to be the target of attackers. You know, if I can do a buffer overflow in your update, in your client-side update technology to take control of the machine, it's one more way into the environment. And sort of think through those things. Like I said, the news stories that I posted earlier, I didn't stop because I ran out of news stories. I stopped because I ran out of room on the slide. Just to take a and take that onto the consideration. The third thing that's why is create big update workflows and create something that's simple for developers to use, whether it's like an update for the Java runtime environment, maybe, where, you know, people don't have to write their update code, they just use your developed package thing. Or it just, you know, it's a silent updater. They do have a lot of that just for organizations. And they definitely the one goal that I've been trying to do. If you have questions on about any of the stuff I talked about, you can find me on Twitter. We have a blog from the security team. We talk about the updaters there. If you want information on how our updaters work, and you have references to the different updaters, where we describe, you know, Windows, we use a task scheduler, a Mac, we use a cracking name of the data that we use in Mac to check our original products. But we've actually documented a lot of the stuff that we've done for the different installers. So if you have questions or if you want references to, you know, more in-depth in terms of how we've actually implemented these, feel free to reach out to me. I can you back to them, you sit down and say, document it. You pull them out. So now I'll take any questions.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, that's fantastic.
Yeah, so just out of historical curiosity, Macromedia, before Adobe swallowed it, was one of the earliest companies to be looking at app store models and stuff historically in like late 90s even and stuff. Has any of that fed into this, or is just, did you independently do that?
We still definitely have a number of people who work at Macromedia. In our organization, the director of my group is a Macromedia employee. Adobe has pretty good research relationship. I think at least three people on my team were originally Macromedia employees after the Adobe acquisition. The Adobe acquisition was 2006, something like that. So we definitely saw a lot of that mindset around in terms of thinking about things. But if I were to hazard a guess, I would say it's probably more the adoption that the other people have done the market is. And we were looking at a way to give the user a familiar experience, right? Something that they would be used to. Because, like I said, the user is just the simplest thing possible. So we could create our own UI or some special stuff. Or say, well, we can start to look like the people in the App Store. Going forward, especially as we're going to start to migrate from the same and you know, Mac OS and team you work in their app stores. So going with them all in a certain sense in terms of that's what the future is going to look like. Yes?
Security question. So my organization and the organization I was at before lived with expired certificates. So whenever I logged into an internal website, I'd get the error message from the browser, and
right.
You know, do you want to proceed and all that kind of stuff. Do you see replacements for the certificate model on the horizon at all?
I see people trying to make the model work better. So one of the things that like Firefox is doing is like once I have a certificate error, say you have mixed content, right? You have a web page, some of the links are going to HTTPS, some of the links are going to HTTP. And when you have mixed content where you're pulling trusted and untrusted stuff together, the browser assumes it's all untrusted because it only takes one untrusted thing to ruin the security of everything that you download the SSL. So they're being more aggressive in terms of going after that sort of stuff. I would expect CAs and operating systems are probably going to get better about validating and giving people stricter warnings now that it's becoming a bigger issue. So it's okay if certificates expire as long as the code is signed before the expiration of that certificate. Right? And so one of the things you do when you sign code is put a timestamp in there. That way, if the certificate is out of date, you check the timestamp when it was signed. And if it was signed before the certificate went out of date, you're still good to go. Right? So if you have a signed version of Atari Pac-Man from 1984 or something, you can still play as date because chances are they signed it before the certificate expired. As long as it's signed before it expired, everything's fine. There's room for improvement in terms of how the CAs revoke certificates. And there's room for improvement on how the operating systems deal with stuff. Like on Windows won't actually block you from installing stuff unless you put the certificate in the untrusted store. So if you know Internet Explorer, you go to security settings, there's a place where you put the certificates, that's where you put your personal certificates and stuff like that. And one, you know, so you got to tap the personal certificates, you got to tap the CA certificates that are installed in the browser, and then there's another tab for untrusted. And if someone puts the certificate in the untrusted store, the operating system blocks you completely from installing it. If the certificate is wrote via CRL, via VeriSign or bot or something like that, creating a certificate revocation list, and when your certificate is broken, the list will revoke certificates. The operating system will give you a scarier file, but it will still allow you to install. You can still click through and say, no, this I don't care, just install, try and get my work done, install, right? On Mac has been moving towards Gatekeeper, where you have Gatekeeper certificates, things like that. And so like Adobe now signs all our Macs all the Gatekeeper certificates. And that's allowing them to have a little bit more control over sign code within the Mac operating system. But if you install something outside of Gatekeeper, the only way you can tell whether the certificate is revoked is there's I forget the name of the command line. You run like search utilities or something like that. You have to run a command line to check the validity of the changes and sure the application is installed. Otherwise, Mac is sort of close enough. So I would expect you'll probably see the Mac operating system, the Apple guys starting to leverage Gatekeeper, where they're going with Gatekeeper in the App Store. As a way to serve that product. So I think that too much of the industry is embedded into this design model for them to turn ship on time, especially when there's room for improvement. So I would expect what's more likely to happen is the industry will be more strict about stuff moving forward. And you know, eventually we may have like the HTML5 official certificates for serving that. For now, I suspect people will see better about certificate.
And my guess is the IT folks just don't want to pay for it.
Well, the IT folks will do whatever makes their life simpler. So, your very changing model will be slow with IT folks because then you can't program all the operating systems, right? Windows 8 in an enterprise environment will be very slow to distribute because you have to retrain everybody. Enterprises aren't going to deal with that. But if it reduces their workload, it reduces the number of like malware responses they have to do and all that sort of stuff, they will eventually be able to do this. They're still motivated to make their lives simpler and their days shorter, just like everybody else. So, I think if it works, yes, people will be picked up, and it would be slow because it's stuff like that. But they
would have done that.
Any other questions?
Sure. So this might be a little, maybe a subtle question, but on mobile devices, there's tons and tons of updates on software. And I think part of the reason is that the way you have to design your apps on those almost has to support updates because you have to be able to sort of kill your app when you switch away from it and restart it and reload its memory. So when you went to this cloud model for the creative suite, do you see that affecting the way those apps are built? That now that there are updates that can come out more frequently, do they have some of those attributes? So for example, if you're in the middle of Photoshop and an update comes up, can you just install the update and it kills and restarts and everything comes back where it was before? Or are they still more in the desktop model of you just shut it down and you come up from scratch each time? Where does that affect things at all?
It has. The first generation of it was still basically a button for downloading the installer and everything worked as it did before. It was they didn't have time for you to do that. Some of the privacy are moving workflow going, allowing things to restart. The biggest thing I see with mobile applications, like one of the challenges we had with the Android App Store and Flash Player, was when we were doing the big Flash Android push, by default the app is not set to auto-update. And you, as in user, you can go into the App Store and you can say, no, just go ahead and update it whenever it's available and prompt and just do it. And Android will do it. But that's something the user has to choose. It won't actually update. It won't allow the app to say, make me an auto-update app. And it won't, that won't happen unless the user goes in and changes the settings. Or Android and changes something. Who does that? I don't know if that's true for the most recent version of Play. My personal Android phones, Android Rise, is a whole parish of that. But that was part of the gas of like our update levels. Because some of those version numbers reflected mobile devices. And so chances are the original CloudFlare you have is whatever version of the manufacturer installed. Right? Or whichever one you downloaded when you signed one of the CloudFlare developers. Maybe you go and update, pay attention to the play updates. That was one of the challenges we had. Especially on mobile devices. In the early days of mobile devices, being able to ship updates was really important because one of the technological challenges of Flash Mobile was the fact that you had all these different manufacturers creating mobile devices. They all have different chipsets. And one of the main some features of Flash is that it processes video really well, so it lets you to so you want to be able to do GPU acceleration on top. But all these different manufacturers all have different GPUs, depending on how much they invested in the phone and expensive model or cheap model and stuff like that. So we're designing the Android updater. Part of what we had to do was notify the Play Store that an update was available, and then also we have this like version check thing. List of okay, so Motorola Atrix, you go here, but this is Samsung Galaxy, you get this update, this Barnes & Noble Nook, you get this update. Because they all have different hardware, different chipsets, different GPUs. So one of the challenges was that we had to have hardware-specific updates, which added to the complexity of having just version updates, just on hardware-specific updates. And you have to go through the security analysis of like, how do you make sure to put the right one, and they just have to check your SSL, all that sort of stuff. So that was also an additional thing. So for a lot of Android apps, like a lot, if you're a small business, create like a Hello World Android app, just enough so that you can say you have one and look modern and hip. But like, you go and install the app and it's got like two tabs. This is a bus code. but if you're trying to do something advanced, if you're trying to be FlashFlare, or you're trying to be Hulu app, or you're trying to be anything that takes advantage of the hardware, or screen sizes, you all have different screen sizes, so how do you scale your apps and fit multiple tiny ones, and then you've got the pocket ones, which are red, and then you've got the actual ones that hook up to a TV screen, so you have to be able to get TV resolution. So one of the challenges in the mobile environment is being able to develop and all that if you're doing something more advanced than just rudimentary stuff. Or like game developers who are a primary audience, they want to take advantage of all this. It's got to be quite tight. You can't have like little power glasses sticking in the middle of your game, otherwise people throw their phone through the window. Being able to track all that was one of the challenges. Either that or you have a really large update with a bunch of pound apps for different environments, which is also not optimal because it's going to take them, charge $20 data services every time they update your app. So the mobile devices were actually a challenge for us because we were trying to do hardware specific stuff. So it's all of them. And we're kind of, it was a challenge to keep up with all the different chipsets that are out there in the market. Like right now, my personal Linux server is a mini PC. So basically, it's like a USB device. And they call them like mini TVs. It's a little hardware device up, 8 by 8 runs at 5 watts, and runs Android. And you can set up dual boot and two boot. And that's higher than the fan noise of my desktop. So I replaced it with a little that's that big. And now I have a Linux server that's 5 watts, it's that big, so you can have a TV, you can see it. But because, with that might be one of the Android devices that you're shipping to, is a little Android mini TV, which has HDMI out to my monitor. So you want to have HDMI, you want to be able to have your app work on the HDMI screens for all monitors, in addition to the little phone. Any other questions? Yeah.
Could you talk about how you assign release numbers? I mean, you went from, you know, hundreds down to...
Dick Twain said die. No, actually, part of it was just getting everything in sync. So part of the reason why we had different version numbers is it was based on the build. It was based on the build number. Every day, every time you update the code, you get a build number. And because we had to deal with different updates, cycles for different things, so it was possible that we would ship an update solely for Android. So the Android version number, we got to increment the build number for Android to handle those hardware problems I talked about, but we were going to update the desktop software. So you'd have Android on one version number, and then you would have the normal desktop flashbacks on the version number. And at the same time, we were working on doing the integration with Chrome. And getting FlashBlade running in a security sandbox and be integrated with Chrome. And in the early days of the Chrome integration, we started shipping it as integrated with Chrome before we had a bug or before we had all the issues. So for a sandbox, basically what you do is you limit what processing you do. You intentionally limit your own privileges so that if you exploit my code, you take control of my DLL. Maybe a level doesn't have a lot of privileges they can't go over. So, before, FlashBlade would run with whatever privileges the user was, and some systems that the user had. So, if you put yourself in a sandbox, you can say, yeah, that's fine that you're admin, but I don't want to be an admin, I don't want to be responsible for having admin privileges. So, I'm going to downgrade the privileges in my process so that I can go. So, that's sort of what sandbox is. But the problem with doing that is you have to create brokers to handle all the privilege requests and stuff. So it calls the printer, you have to access the device driver and then so anyway, so we're doing pretty fast iterations on the Chrome versions because there are bugs and we're dealing with sandbox. So the Chrome would be incremented. You know, we'd have different build numbers for the Chrome versions. Today things have sort of evened out where we're now in the rapid fire of Android. Chrome is stable. Windows 8 is stable. So then it's rare that we have to do an update for a specific platform if you remember that specific platform. So that's what helped us consolidate.
So what I heard you say is that the reason you don't have so many version numbers anymore is that you stopped making, you no longer have the necessity to make version specific or platform-specific kinds of versions.
Right. We still do from time to time for various reasons, but it's not... During that time that chart was going on, everything was on fire. Chrome was off on its doing its stuff, Android was doing its stuff, and there were just versions of it everywhere.
I was hopeful you had a nice, clever procedure that people
no,
could
apply. No, we just unified our development model and those things sort of stabilized itself. Now we just do one update for everyone. There's still a little bit of that. We haven't completely eliminated it, but it's less than that. So, for instance, if there was a vulnerability that targeted specifically Android, we might need to prevent Android without updating everybody if that's not smart. Why would people do that thing that they need to? Anything else? Yeah.
So you have two types of updates, in my opinion. The security updates, which you want to ship out really, really fast, as in yesterday.
Right.
And the feature rich updates,
which
you don't want to disturb the client, the end user, you want to ship them as polished as possible. Right? Have you ever considered treating these two fundamentally different?
Yes. We have. And sometimes we do. So we have... like I said, we have different update channels that we want to do. So everybody knows what silent update is. If you're actually prompting the user with like an update, hey, there's an update there. We call that a lot of release because it's the opposite of silent. So there, in FlashBlade, for instance, we maintain both update channels. So we do silent, like create update and install, or we have to prompt the user for whatever reason. We can still ship a lot of things. A lot of things aren't going to have the same adoption rate because of a couple of reasons. One, just because people will choose
more into it. The original lab updater was based on needing to reboot the machine for this long time to get DLLs in use. We fixed some of that, but still, the check rate isn't quite the same. So we do treat them fundamentally. We kept both options open to us because we needed both options. And also, sound, you know, occupy bills are peaks. So we have, so it's not all updates, more expensive, of course, so if we don't have to do the rush, you know, we may need a loud update to control the peaks. So, usually that might build in the direct enforcement. You could be one of the reasons why we do it. Yeah. So yes, yeah, so we do maintain both updates. It's more likely to be a cause is, you know, if it's going to be a significant change and it may break some overflow. We might do a lot of it, just so that they will be aware that their system changed and they'll be able to go, oh, they probably broke this by that update. And then when they call tech support to report the bug, they can say, I applied your update and then I can't do stuff. Whereas with the sound model update, everything just stops. Right. So that's another reason to do that. We think it's going to be a fundamental change. They want to do it loud. It's just that it's easier for us to do it. Does that answer your question?
I see that even as an even driver, it's part of sound updates. So the sound updates, you're not going to break anything.
Right.
And at the same time, it looks like if you attempt to apply a silent update on the fly, for instance, you can't take this offline.
Yeah, you are correct. Like there, we also envision a scenario where we have to do both simultaneously, where you know, what's, because you think through all the worst case scenarios. One of the worst case scenarios is you want to you've got an update that, let's say, changes the UI, so you have to update. You have to do the prompts because people have to agree to the new UI before you actually change their desktop. But at the same time, you have a security vulnerability. So we would have to do two separate builds. We would have to push the older build on the silent update channel. We have to push the loud update on the loud channel. And loud updater needs to be able to deal with the fact that the silent auto updater may or may not have picked in. Sound up all of here, we have to deal with the fact that the validator beat in so much, I need to make sure that the maneuver check go. Well, I'm actually not most used to things, so I would downgrade, you know, do a downgrade. So yeah, we kept the possibility open that we may have to push both of the exact same time. That's the worst case scenario. And downgrade is actually the top themselves. Yeah.
All right, why don't we thank Thomas again?